Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It helps every now and then to just tune out. Don't check what the stock market is doing. Leave those corporate profit reports unread and simply soak up the economic vibe. Had you done that today, though, I'm not sure it would have been all that relaxing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done online at elance.com. American Public Media programs explore the American dream and ask, after our current troubles are over, what's next? More at nextamericandream.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Thursday. Today is the 21st of May. And I realize what I'm asking is easier said than done, closing your ears to straight economic numbers at a time like this. But it really can't help. I mean, how much good would it do you to know that first-time claims for unemployment benefits were down a bit last week, or that an index called Leading Economic Indicators rose just about as much in April as everybody was guessing? Not so much good, right? So let's concentrate instead today on the zeitgeist, the economic environment we're living in, of bailouts and selective government support for ostensibly private companies. We learned today that GMAC is in line to get another $7 billion from the Treasury Department. GMAC is GM's auto financing company, and since its bankruptcy, Chrysler's too. The money would help GMAC make loans to consumers and so help GM and Chrysler, but not Ford, move cars off their lots. From Washington, Tamara Keith reports.
GMAC is critical to both GM and now Chrysler after its finance arm was dissolved in bankruptcy. GMAC financing helps dealers stock their lots and helps consumers buy cars. Bill Visnick is a senior editor at Edmunds Auto Observer.
Car dealers need GMAC to be able to extend that financing to the customers who are coming in the dealerships because nobody can afford to turn away a customer, you know, a live prospect in the dealership right now.
The stress test showed GMAC was in big trouble. Federal regulators said GMAC needed to raise $11.5 billion in capital and admitted it would probably need government help.
Frankly, the balance sheet of this finance company is a wreck.
Marianne Keller is an independent automotive analyst.
So I'm sure that this money is going to be used to help facilitate some great big end of model year blowout sale.
Complete with too good to be true auto finance deals. But imagine being the Ford dealer across the street. Keller says car makers that haven't gotten government help could be at a real disadvantage.
They have to fund their dealers, they have to fund their consumers, and they are going to be competing against two government-controlled entities where it seems that money in any amount is no object.
Money. No object. That's starting to sound familiar. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
As it happens, General Motors took a step back from the brink of bankruptcy today. The company announced a deal with the United Auto Workers Union on how to cut costs and close factories. The smart money, though, still says it's up to GM's bondholders whether or not the carmaker is going to wind up in Chapter 11. It's got about a week and a half left to work something out before the White House deadline is up. AIG CEO Ed Liddy said today he's on his way out. Liddy says he'll resign as soon as a replacement is found. He came out of retirement last September, you might remember, at the request of then-Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. One of the few female CEOs of a Fortune 500 company is stepping down. Anne Mulcahy said today that 8 years of running Xerox is enough. She will be replaced by another woman, Ursula Burns, the company's president. Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agency, made a ratings announcement today, something it does probably dozens of times a day. This one's a bit different, though. It lowered its assessment of the entire UK economy. S&P says the country's public finances are deteriorating faster than expected, and government borrowing has skyrocketed. Sound familiar? From London, Stephen Beard reports.
Britain has never defaulted on its government debt. The UK has always enjoyed the top credit rating, AAA. But today, Standard & Poor's revised the UK's outlook down from stable to negative. Economist Andrew Hilton.
This is a warning that if the government doesn't get the UK's finances in order, the UK also faces a downgrade from AAA.
That would make it more costly to borrow, and this year the UK needs to borrow more than ever before, a total of $330 billion. That could already be more difficult, just as a result of today's lower rating. Peter Hahn of the Cass Business School.
It's almost a warning for international bondholders to say, beware. So investors are going to be a bit circumspect of buying UK government bonds tomorrow more than they were today.
This could have implications for the US. S&P said it was worried that British government debt could reach 100% of GDP within a few years. Neil McKinnon of the ECU Currency Group says there are similar forecasts for America.
This is a shot across the bows for the US Treasury and US policymakers. Certainly, debt GDP levels of 100%, I think, are not compatible with a AAA rating.
The US economy is five times bigger than Britain's. With the world's main reserve currency, the US is in a much stronger position than the UK. But McKinnon says the recent weakness of the dollar suggests that markets are starting to worry a little about America's credit. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Forget casual Fridays. The new recession trend is furlough Fridays. Tomorrow, state, county, and city offices from Connecticut to Seattle are going to be shut down temporarily as employees are forced to take unpaid leave. And Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports that government workers aren't the only ones.
In the white-collar world, this form of temporary leave without pay has been largely absent until now. Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld is an employment expert at the University of Illinois. He says in a global knowledge-based economy, layoffs are now seen as a last resort.
Knowledge and skills that employers have invested in are more valuable than ever. And so if there is a way to retain talent rather than lay it off, employers will prefer that to retain their investments.
It also positions companies to respond quickly once the economy recovers. Universities, high-tech firms, and publishing companies, among others, are embracing the furlough as a way to cut costs without cutting staff. But employment lawyer Robert Dustin says there is a downside.
Some of those people who are being furloughed, if you do it across the board, could be extremely productive.
But he says that's the nature of furloughs. The idea is to spread the pain evenly across the entire company. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, the pain could have been spread across a whole lot of places. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just as we don't know how the recession and the financial crisis are going to end, so we don't really know exactly what happened to get us here either. Yes, we realize there was a real estate bust and some egregious financial shenanigans on Wall Street. But the case can be made that unless we understand exactly how the crisis happened, we might be doomed to repeat it. Last night, the president agreed with Congress that this is one of those things that needs its own commission, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, to be precise. North Dakota Democrat Kent Conrad was one of the sponsors of the bill. Senator, good to have you with us.
You bet. Good to be with you.
On the theory that a financial crisis waits for no one, how soon do you think this commission can get to work?
Well, it can get to work as soon as the members are named, but we're not asking for the results until December of next year because we want to keep it out of the political process, keep it out of the elections, so that we can get a very clear, objective review of what occurred in the financial collapse, why it happened, who's responsible, and how do we prevent it from happening again.
If we're lucky, though, this whole thing, this recession and financial crisis, will be in the rearview mirror by the end of next year. Aren't you worried that's just a little bit too long?
No, I think the purpose of this commission is really to make certain that we understand all of the factors that came together to create almost a global financial collapse so that we know what can be done to guard against it ever happening in the future. And, you know, that doesn't prevent us from taking steps now based on what we already believe and what we already know. But this is modeled after the 9/11 Commission. And we think it requires a more reflective, long-term, completely out of partisan politics review of what happened and what are the steps that can be taken so that we keep this from happening.
You're also empowering this commission to refer cases to the Attorney General. Are you expecting to find that laws have been broken, that people actually engaged in crimes in this whole thing?
I do. I believe There was serious financial fraud in some of the dealings, some of the major enterprises. I believe there's criminal wrongdoing.
Obviously, you'll be looking at Wall Street and what some of the folks up there did. Are you going to look equally as hard at what happened in Washington? Regulatory agencies there, some of the things Congress might have done?
Absolutely. All of us need to have our actions scrutinized. And I would include Congress in that. What mistakes were made here? What were mistakes that were made by major financial firms, by regulatory agencies? Certainly the rating agencies, they were asleep at the switch. Where did the breakdowns occur that we need to fix and make certain never happen again?
Once we figure all that out, though, Senator, how is this going to help individual investors, retirees, pension holders, you know, the people who make this economy go?
I think it will help by restoring confidence and also helping us all understand what are the risk factors out there that weren't fully appreciated and not properly scrutinized and not dealt with effectively.
Kent Conrad, Democrat of North Dakota. Senator, thanks very much for your time.
Good to be with you.
Our colleagues at American Radio Works have been putting together a documentary about the city of Muncie, Indiana, about how it's been completely flattened by this recession and by the loss of virtually all of its old line manufacturing jobs. But they also told us about a new piece of machinery that Muncie is counting on to help bring the city at least part of the way back. It sounded almost like a riddle when they told us about it. It's as big as a Volkswagen Bug, they said, with the precision of a Swiss watch. So a couple of weeks ago, I went to Muncie to see what I could find. At the County Economic Development Office, I met Jacobo Tozzi. He's the U.S. Managing Director for the Italian heavy equipment maker Brevini.
It weighs between 20 and 30 tons, which is very technically very complicated. It has not to make any noise. It has to resist 20 years. So it's the top of the mechanical industry in the world at the moment.
It's a gearbox for those huge wind turbines that are part of the future of green energy. Brevini is setting up a factory to make those cutting-edge gearboxes right here in Muncie.
We are going to hire people with mechanical skills.
Which is part of the reason why the company chose this city.
Unfortunately, there was also a plant which closed in Muncie, so we can find people with competence here.
So in a way, the economic problems of Muncie gave you an opportunity.
Yes.
Some of the people who are looking for those Brevini manufacturing jobs used to work here at this BorgWarner factory. It's huge, stretches half a mile along the road here. There were 3,000 people making transmissions for Ford and General Motors until a couple of years ago. Thing is, there aren't too many cars and trucks parked in front because almost nobody works inside anymore. Workers here at the BorgWarner plant and at a Chevy factory across town used to belong to the United Auto Workers Union. You can still find some of them hanging out at the union hall, even though their local went out of business.
I've already filled an online application and sent my resume in.
Larry Toole was an officer at UAW Local 287. He's 55. And he's hoping Brevini recognizes what he has to offer.
Well, because of my qualifications, my skills, and my training and education. I worked in the manufacturing for 30 years, repairing machines and building tools and dies and fixtures. And I'd be an asset to him for all the knowledge and training that I've got from BorgWarner.
Jacobo Tozzi, the U.S. rep for Brevini, says Larry Toole is the kind of worker that the company's looking for. Problem is, the unemployment rate in Muncie is pushing 11%, which means there are thousands of people just as qualified as Larry Toole. And they're all waiting for 450 production jobs that aren't even scheduled to come online until 2011. Officials up and down Indiana are hoping Brevini and companies like it can help turn the state's industrial base into a force in green energy, or anything, really, that'll help as the economic ground changes underneath them once again. You can hear more about how the Great Recession has changed Muncie in an American Radio Works documentary called Hard Times in Middletown. It's on public radio stations across the country. Coming up, baby burgers, tiny donuts, the latest in fast food.
Consumers obviously were a little bit excited about this. You can't discount that. Cute works.
Cute works. But first, let's do the numbers. The thought of a long, hot, and possibly not so economically fabulous summer wilted the markets today. The Dow Industrials dumped 129 points, 1.5%, ended at 82.92. The NASDAQ peeled off 32 points, 1.9%, finished at 16.95. The S&P 500 lost 15 points, 1.75%, went up at 8.88. No surprise that the cut in Britain's credit outlook rattled the markets today. Big manufacturers lost some pizzazz, too. United Technologies shed nearly 1%. Boeing dipped nearly 3%. Aluminum maker Alcoa unwrapped more than 4% today. Giant oil field contractor Schlumberger fell 5.75% on an oil slick. Deere treated 6.75% lower. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Producemore, conservemore.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone. From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, a House committee holds a hearing about lingering housing issues in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. President Obama delivers the commencement address at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. And the United Nations marks International Day for Biological Diversity. This year, the focus is on the threat of invasive alien species. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Earlier this week, the president announced tougher fuel economy and emission standards for car and truck makers. The White House figures the new rules will save almost 2 billion barrels of oil over the next 9 years and, at the same time, make it easier for us to breathe. Seems like common sense, but commentator Paul Kodrosky says good economic sense is something else again.
After years of auto companies saying that higher fuel efficiency standards would bankrupt them, the Obama administration figured out a fix. Cleverly, it wiped out the auto industry first and then raised fuel standards. The right calls the standards an unnecessary intrusion into the economic lives of average Americans. If people want to buy massive steel-clad gunboats and race down highways at top speed, getting 5 miles per gallon, all the while patting the pockets of America-hating fuel exporters, then that should be their right. Environmental sorts on the left have complaints, too. Some are already saying that 39 miles per gallon is not high enough. They point to Europe, where it is common now for many popular cars to get 50 miles per gallon and more. But a more compelling criticism comes from recent economics research. To an economist, most things come down to price. A car that gets 39 miles per gallon is cheaper per mile to drive than a car that gets 18 miles per gallon. Make iPods cheaper and more gets sold. Make the cost per mile of driving cheaper and people will drive more. How much more? Research says it may be as much as 10 to 20%. People may not loiter on their way to work, but they will make more discretionary trips with their high-efficiency cars. And that has other effects, too, like more highway congestion and even more accidents and deaths. Most sane people, even economists, want more efficient cars on the roads. But is the best way to do it making cars cheaper to drive? To an economist, the answer is obvious. We need to make it more expensive to drive, not cheaper. And the best way to do that? Raise fuel prices. Higher gas taxes will cause people to drive less, cause emissions to tumble, and motivate companies to build and sell more efficient cars. Granted, it might not be the same auto companies doing it, but I think we're all okay with that.
Paul Kudrowski is a senior fellow at the Kauffman Foundation. His blog is called Infectious Greed. You can find a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, send us your thoughts about what Paul said or anything else you hear on the broadcast. Click on that link that says Contact. In New York City today, the Somali teenager charged with piracy in the Maersk, Alabama case pleaded not guilty. The kidnapping of Captain Richard Phillips grabbed a lot of headlines and did nothing at all to change the image we all probably have of pirates as ruthless criminals. Economics professor Peter Leeson offers a different take, though, that they're really businessmen, not for a profit. In his new book on the pirate economy called The Invisible Hook, Leeson says that goes for the Somali pirates of today and the ones back in the 18th century, too.
The first thing to note about the organizational structure is that it was extremely flat. Pirate crews were somewhere around 80 members, although you could have much larger crews, some of several hundred. They would typically popularly elect a captain and another officer called the quartermaster. Around this system of democratic organization, there was this system of constitutionalism. Pirates wrote down, oddly enough, a system of social rules that governed how booty would be divided up. It regulated activities that were likely to cause conflicts on board, such as gambling. It regulated smoking and drinking to make sure that pirates were in tip-top shape for overtaking potential prizes. And these constitutions were drawn up in advance of a plundering expedition by all the members of the would-be crew.
Is it possible, just as a way to understand this, to think of the pirate ship as a company or a corporation?
It was a profit-maximizing organization. The individuals who got together were sort of stockholders in the corporation, if you will. The pirate ship was owned more or less equally by each member of the pirate crew, and they divided up their plunder, the dividends, if you will, according to a share-based system.
Are there remnants of that 18th century system that we see today with these Somali pirates, for example?
It doesn't appear that modern pirates are using a democratic form of governance. And I think the reason for that is that the crew members and the captain, if you will, of a modern Somali pirate crew is probably appointed by the landed financier, kind of tribal chieftains who provide the seed capital for ships, who has an interest in making sure a captain of his choosing is sort of in charge. With that difference aside, what you do see are this sort of rules of social organization emerging about how to divide up booty. And there's also a kind of judiciary system.
Can we trace the money that they get from, say, a ship's ransom? So the landed financier gets his certain kickback. The crew members divide their share. What's left over and where does it go?
It's been estimated maybe 25% to 30% of the ransom that a pirate crew receives is kicked back to the financier. Some remaining portion, which is probably where the vast majority of it goes, is divided up among the various pirates. Then you have a pirate economy, a network of cooks, for example, almost a kind of pirate catering system, if you will, and the people who provide pirates with various pieces of capital who need to get paid.
What about the source of a lot of that income, these shipping companies? First, I guess you have to consider the real risk of harm that may come to the crews, or is it so real a risk?
That's a really important question, actually. It seems that it's not a very strong risk at all. The reason that the hostages don't seem to be in any real danger is not because pirates are especially nice people, but again, because they're greedy, because they're profit-seeking. And we know that a dead or even injured hostage would fetch a very low or no ransom.
You know, in the case of the Maersk, Alabama and Captain Phillips, what happened there was skewed because it was an American-flagged vessel. But in general, what I hear you saying is it makes more sense for companies to pay the ransom and move on.
Piracy still remains a very, very small problem. I mean, last year, I think we had something slightly fewer than 300 pirate attacks, and we're on par this year to have roughly the same number, which is, I think, part of the reason why we see commercial ships not taking a whole lot of preventative measures to try and avoid pirate attack. It might just be cheaper to simply take the low risk and, if in fact you're overtaken, then ransom.
Peter Leeson's an economics professor at George Mason University. His book is called The Invisible Hook, The Hidden Economics of Pirates. Professor Leeson, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Generally speaking, bigger is better in the business world. Market share, economies of scale, it just makes sense. And the rule applies across all kinds of different industries, including usually fast food. But Andrea Gardner explains that in a down economy, consumers want a little something extra with their big value meals.
In the fast food business, small is the new big. Miniatures are popping up everywhere. Burger King has burger shots. McDonald's is testing a tiny version of the Big Mac. Even Krispy Kreme has mini donuts. Scott Hume runs burgerbusiness.com. He says the recession is driving this.
I think it's a time when everybody's looking for a little bit of fun, and little tiny burgers are undeniably cute.
White Castle has always had mini burgers, but this is the first time so many fast food chains have jumped on the tiny bandwagon. Hume says the idea sparked when Sliders became successful in the upscale bar scene.
It's a trend-driven business. When something comes in and it clicks, then all of a sudden you see restaurants at all different price levels thinking, that's a good idea, let's try that.
This isn't about just bringing new customers to the drive-thru. It's also about getting fast food lovers to visit more often. Minis are marketed as a late-night snack. And college student Vince Bauer says that's the only time he'd order mini burgers. He and his roommate, Nick Pignotti, finally tried them after being fascinated by their size.
They're small. I don't know, they look kind of good.
I like them. They're just so tiny. I just think the buns are the funniest looking thing.
Hume says this kind of intrigue drives sales. That's why chains are constantly adding new things to the menu. Think Angus beef, chipotle sauce, or a new dessert. But it's rare that any new menu item is exciting enough to become a thing.
Consumers obviously were a little bit excited about this. You can't discount that. Cute works.
But only for so long. Like everything in fast food, there is a shelf life, and Hume predicts minis will be maxed out by the fall. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, another data point on the economic zeitgeist we started with. Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan said in an interview with Bloomberg today that he's amazed how well things are going. Remarkable was his exact wording. Given Greenspan's track record, that could mean it really is over, or it's about to get a lot worse. In his defense, he did say he's still really nervous about the banks. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 129 points, 1.5%. I guess they didn't hear Mr. Greenspan. The Nasdaq lost 32 points, 1.9%. The S&P 500 dropped 15 points, 1.2%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, just in time for summer, safer pools, but at a price.
For manufacturers, for distributors, for service companies, that's quite a stimulus package. However, for the local pool, they're the ones who are bearing the cost.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.